some of you know me, many of you don't. I'm Warner Jansen, and I was a business manager, general manager of Holden Village from 1963 to 1983. Actually, officially from 1984, they paid me 1 year after I left because I knew where all the valves and switches and I knew where all the keys were, and so they paid me for a year to, I think it was like a severance package, or maybe they were glad to get rid of me. I'm not sure which it was. But anyway, that had a wonderful experience of being here for those 20 years. And those were the first years that Holden Village existed, literally. The nonprofit corporation was really set up in 1961. And it is a nonprofit corporation in the state of not Arizona, that's where I live now, Washington. Got to be careful. And so, in those early years, we always used to say, or somebody asked what Holden Village was, and we'd say, well, it's a nonprofit corporation in the state of Washington, and it's closely associated with Lutheran Church. In recent years, they've designated it as a Lutheran retreat, which, you know, that's neither here nor there, but it was never owned by the Lutheran Church. It was closely associated with the Lutheran Church. And initially, all three synods at that time, it was a Missouri Synod, the LCA, and the, I never can remember all the terms. AELC. Yeah, that was the three that originally had parts in it. And it was really, you know, the early board was very interested in having all Lutherans become involved, which was sort of a unique thing in those days, because I don't know if some of you are Missouri Synod or remember those days, but there was, you couldn't even take communion together between Missouri Synod and some of the other synods. So the hope was that Holden Village would also be an opportunity for finally Lutherans to get together. And I think it actually helped. But it was an interesting part of the history, and I think that's one reason why Holden Village even existed or lasted in, through as many years now. It's, I think, 56 years old. Those early years were very different. But I wanted to also start off with just saying that, I think I finally, after all these years come to a belief in God. I mean, I think I always believed in God, but you know, you always, at least, I think honest people have in the back of their mind, does God really exist? And I need something to help me understand. And for me, in at least in recent years, including the years that I was at Holden, there were sort of three things that I thought of that helped me understand that there is a God. And one is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I don't know if any of you are music lovers, but that's a powerful symphony, and I, after listening to it a number of times over the years, that it just amazed me that, you know, Beethoven, who I think at the time when he wrote it, he was totally deaf, and you know, such a marvelous symphony. There has to be something beyond music knowledge and interest to be able to write something like the Ninth Symphony. So that was one thing for me that says, you know, there's got to be a God. And then the other thing is, in recent years, I moved to the Sonoran Desert in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm sure some of you have been down there, but the desert can be very harsh, not only in terms of temperature, but, you know, the cactus are not very loving landscape, and you've got to be careful. You can't touch them, but they're such they're such marvelous plants, and for the Native Americans, the Tohono O'odham Indians down there, that was part of their source of food, and it's the source of food for many of the animals that live in the desert. And what amazes me, and I guess the other thing that again said there's got to be a God, is that if you are down there, and this very sort of dangerous plant that you can't touch puts out these beautiful blossoms. And not only does it put out the beautiful blossoms, but it's usually at night that they come out. So, I mean, I think God was sort of using humor too and said, you know, if you're going to see these beautiful things, you're going to have to get up early in the morning, and by 10 o'clock, many of them are already gone. And there, it's a marvelous area and a marvelous plant. And again, it at least to me, just, you know, sort of visually and mentally, it says there's got to be more in this world than luck. And I mean, I believe in evolution, and cactus were part of evolution, but there's also a humorous God that is a part of this whole thing. And then the third thing brings us back to Holden Village. And I don't think that God ordained that Holden would ever exist. I mean, I think there are many people that have said that over the years, because it is such a sort of a strange organization that could exist all these years, that God must have ordained that Holden exists. I personally don't think that's true. I think that God was alerted by an angel when Wes Priebe wrote the first letters, and the angel said, you know, there's something funny going on down there, and you better pay some attention to it. And so I think God, you know, recognized this as a very unique opportunity for, you know, people throughout the world, and including the Lutherans. And I think that God got a lot of laughs out of how Holden started, and maybe how Holden even continues to exist. I mean, to think that, you know, I mean, an abandoned mine 40 miles up lake, you have to take a boat to, you can't drive to. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that this place should exist where it does. And I think that's part of the sort of the humor of God, that said, okay, you know, here's a real test. If you think this should exist and it has some purpose in the church and the Holy Spirit is going to be with it, you know, I'll sort of stand by and see if I can't encourage enough people to help you out. And I think that was, you know, basically how Holden got started, because there was no committee set up, you know, like there would be today, that said that, you know, we potentially have a free gift of a community up in the mountains, and we'll do a study on it and do a financial analysis on it and see once it can make a go. Because if they would have done that, they would have said, no, it can't make a go, and therefore we will let it go. We won't do anything with it. In fact, in the early days of Holden, the board went to the North, I think at that time it was called the North Pacific Synod of the old ALC or AELC, you know, and said, you know, won't you take Holden over, be responsible for it and help finance it and so forth. And I remember the reports came back from I think they were having a synod meeting or a conference meeting of the whole Pacific North, and they said, absolutely not, we won't touch it, because it's a white elephant, and we don't want anything to do with it. And so then again, it was back on the board to try to come up with, you know, how are we going to make a go of this? And even in the early years, Dr. Bergstrand was the first person that they offered the directorship to. And he was the youth director of the old LCA, so he was basically retired, because now the LCA was merged with some of the other Lutheran groups. And he was up here a number of times for programming and for, you know, sort of considering the offer. And finally, after a year, he still hadn't made up his mind. And so the board said, okay, you know, we've got to move on from here. And so then they chose Carol Henderly, who also, he was a youth director for the old ELC, and also was without a job because of a merger, and was a very unique, dynamic theologian. And so that they offered the job to him, and he accepted it. And so that's really how he got involved, and how Holden got started in those early years. I'm not against you know, the idea of detailed business plans and so forth, but I think that a lot of nonprofits that get started nowadays, you know, some of them go through a detailed analysis and survive and do well, and others, you know, have a good idea but just can't put together the concept, and they die away. Well, fortunately, Holden, I think, had the opportunity of really starting without anybody thinking it would ever survive. And even with you know, how the facility got here, the mine and the 20 or 30, I mean, the 20 years that the mine was in operation from 57 to, I mean, 37 to 57. And it was a marginal mine. And when they first came up here to, when Howe Sound bought the mine or the mining rights, they had an engineer come up here that was responsible, I think, for 2 or 3 years he spent here to assay the mine and try to determine how much ore was there, how many years it would last, and what the profitability of the mine would be. And it was right on the margin. I think he said that it would be 20-year operation, which it turned out to be. I can't remember. He stated that it would be, you know, I don't remember if it was a 10% profit on the investment, and it turned out to be whatever he said. So it was, he was right on the money, but it was right on the verge of not being feasible for even Howe Sound to open this mine. And, you know, there were a number of things in those early years that almost made it impossible for the mine to continue. I think it was in 1936 that they had a major fire in Copper Basin. And, you know, the mine had been doing work up there to drilling holes to determine where the ore was and so forth, and so the Forest Service automatically assumed that it was, the fire had started by the operation of the mine. And so that Gordon Stewart, who some of you may recognize the name at least, he was a long-term resident of Domke Lake. He lived there for, I think, 40 years all by himself, and was a wonderful individual, a little quirky, but wonderful. He was the forest ranger at the time that this fire took place, and there was a trail from Lucerne to Holden, and he was bringing the supervisor, Otto Wenatchee, from the Forest Service up to hand, Barquist was the engineer with Howe Sound, to hand Barquist a bill for $50,000, I think it was. And because that's what they determined was the cost of whatever suppression they did. And on the way up here, Gordon Stewart noticed that there was a tree in Copper Basin that had been hit by lightning and was likely the start of the fire. And so that the Forest Service supervisor came down and talked to Barquist and said, here is the bill I was going to give you, but we've determined it was caused by lightning and therefore you're not responsible for it. And Barquist was up here quite a number of years ago. I mean, it was even, I guess it was the last few years that I was here, and he related some of these stories, and he too was saying that how unbelievable it was that Holden Village as a retreat center was here at this time because of all these sort of quirky things that have happened. And he related this story and said that if they would have gotten this bill from the Forest Service, the Howe Sound would have pulled out of here. They wouldn't have continued the operation because it was so marginal the way it was. So there's you know, there's all kinds of things like that again that you know, just make it amazing that Holden ever got started. And but I guess it also says that, you know, maybe God didn't foreordain it, but certainly didn't he put the right people in the right place at the right time to allow things to take place. And I think the remediation was a necessary project and probably a great project, but it always made me sort of sad that you know, like the old mill building was going to be destroyed, and even the tailings, which were a mess and caused a lot of pollution, but they were a sign of, you know, how Holden Village came about, you know. And I think it was in the early years, it was sort of accepted because we couldn't do anything about it. It was just an accepted part of the history of Holden that, you know, the mine existed. We benefited from, you know, what they did. And all mines, in a sense, are pollution, but also we're dependent on mining in this world. Even though we don't like mines, we need the copper, we need the gold, we need the, you know, all the things for the electronics nowadays. And so what do you do? I mean, I guess the governments around the world haven't been very good about having the mine companies clean up. And even, you know, Rio Tinto wasn't the one that mined here. It was Howe Sound Company. And there's probably, I don't know, 5, 6 mine companies that have been involved in the ownership of basically this mine since Howe Sound closed it down. But Rio Tinto ended up with it, and that's why they were up here with the remediation. And so it's, you know, if there wouldn't have been a mine, if there wouldn't have been tailings, there wouldn't have been Holden Village. And so I think it's, you know, not really tongue-in-cheek, but it's, you know, we do have to realize and we do have to appreciate the fact that Holden is only here because of the mine, and the remediation now will take away some of the visual history, and you know, that's neither bad or good, it's just the fact, and hopefully the environment will be better without it. But, I mean, during the years of Holden, I mean, in the early years, we tried to do some things with the tailings because we were living next to them, and we saw the dust storms. In recent years, people have come up here, they haven't seen those, but and fortunately, most of the dust storms were, I mean, the wind would come up and it would blow it down the valley. So in the village, we got minimal amount of dust. I mean, we did get dust, but it was minimal compared with what was down the valley. And but we tried to do some things. We contacted the Forest Service and said, you know, can we try planting some things up there? And, you know, they didn't care because it wasn't going to cost them any money, and we couldn't ruin it any more than what it was. So, you know, we had a project in the early days when we were composting. We would take compost up to the tailings and mix it with soil and with tailings, and we'd plant trees. And we had some nice pine trees growing up there. Of course, it wasn't enough to cut down the dust, but it did prove that something could happen. And in those early days, we had good contact with Washington State University. And Leo Bustead was the head of the School of Veterinary Medicine, and I can't remember, but anyway, there was a fellow that was very much involved in the Department of Agriculture at Washington State, and through some of these people, we got a graduate student to come up here at no cost to us or the Forest Service. It was just a graduate student needed a project, and he came up and tried to determine how much tailings were blowing down the valley to see once, you know, to come up with some data, you know, where we could maybe send to the Forest Service or to some organization in the government and say, you know, this is a serious problem. And what he did, it was a very simple thing. And we saved plastic containers that were all the same size. I don't remember if they were 5-gallon buckets or smaller, but and he set up a grid for us to establish at various places on both on the, this side of the river as well as the other side of the river, and then at measured sections down the valley. And then we put those out in the spring of the year, and in the fall we collected all of them and then weighed each bucket to determine how much tailings had actually blown down the valley. And this was some of the early data. Now, I don't think that Rio Tinto used any of that data, although somebody may have told him there was a dust problem, and we proved that, and it's probably at WSU someplace in the archives, because this graduate student, I think, used it for, you know, some of his graduate work. But, I mean, we did some things out there that did that, and you know, and again, in the early years, Holden was very primitive compared with what it is now. First time I came up here was back then, September 1961, and it was to dedicate the diesel electric plants. I think they're still down there. I haven't been down the road, but the initial electricity for Holden was 250 kilowatt diesel electric motors that were purchased. Actually, they were reconditioned from a fishing village up in Alaska, and brought down by, I think it's called NC Machinery out of Seattle, that dealt with heavy equipment. And there was a contact working there that was a member of one of the Lutheran churches that helped arrange all of this. We had to purchase them, but and that was how I got up here the first time, was come up to attend the dedication of that. And they had, I remember they had flyers in all the bulletins in Seattle churches. And, you know, to come up and visit Holden, get acquainted with it, and attend the dedication. So I came up with, who was my roommate at that time from Purdue University, and we came up here that weekend, and I think there were 30 people that came up, and we all rode up from Lucerne on the back of the on the back of the flatbed truck, that they didn't have any buses or anything, so the luggage was put on first so it was safe, and then we piled on. We piled on after the luggage and rode up the hill, and we were here for the weekend. And I don't know if some of you are from the Seattle area, if you remember Stan Borison, he was an entertainer on King Broadcasting Company, and he also was a member, I think he was a member of I can't remember, not Ballard Lutheran.
Ballard First, yeah, he was.
Which one?
Ballard First.
Yeah. And so he was the entertainment. I mean, typical for dedication, you have to have some entertainment, and you have to have a pastor to bless it. And Pastor Brown from Finney Ridge was the person that came up to do the officiating of the process. And then Stan Borison, he was a Norwegian singer and comedian and very well liked in the Seattle area and was on television for many, many years. And anyway, the dedication was held in the village center. Of course, we didn't have any electricity, so it was, and this was September, so it was dark and cold in there. And they had it set up so at a certain time during the process, they would give the signal, and Reuben Thompson, who was the first really resident of Holden Village, was down at the diesel plant and was going to throw the switch, and lights would come on, and we would probably sing a song and have a prayer, and that would be it. And nothing happened. And pretty soon, Reuben came walking up the road and said, wire burned off, it'll be just a few minutes and we'll have it back in operation. And a little time later, the lights came on, and in a sense, Holden Village sort of started at that point. And at least Holden started at that point in terms of having some comforts, because prior to that, there was no electricity here. That weekend, there was no, in fact, for the first year, several years, there was no heat in any of the buildings. There was no hot water in any of the buildings except for the kitchen that had. And at that time, the kitchen had these old, I think they were shipboard, they heated the grills and the ovens with diesel fuel. And so Reuben would come in the morning at 5 a.m. and start the diesel fuel grills and so forth, and that's how the food was cooked. And during the mine days, that's what they used. And for a number of years, that's all we had. But there was heat in the dining room, so I mean, dining room was very popular because that was the only place where there was heat and hot water. And so, I mean, one little thing that I remember, I started as manager in 1963, and I remember one mature person came up to me and she said, I just want to let you know my faucet is dripping, and I said. I said, well, you know, you're lucky to have water coming out of that closet.
That's right.
And she understood what I was saying, and she smiled and was happy. But, I mean, it was very primitive here compared with what it is now. And, you know, Holden has really developed in a marvelous way and through a lot of innovations with a lot of people. But it was very primitive when it started, and people still came. And I think that, but again, whether it was, I mean, whether it was luck or God or Wes Priebe, I'm not sure, but Holden came into being at about the right time in history, because I think if it would have happened any earlier than that or maybe much later than that, I don't think Holden ever would have come into being or survived. Because there was, Holden had no publicity. You know, they try to publicize it through the Lutheran church groups. And fortunately, in 1962, you probably remember that the World's Fair was in Seattle in 1962. And since it was in Seattle, that meant that a lot of Lutherans from Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota were going to come and visit friends in Seattle to go to the World's Fair. Well, fortunately, somebody associated with Holden, I guess it was Gilberg and some others, maybe Bergstrom, they got articles, I think, in the Lutheran Standard that was, you know, being published, and the LCA had similar. Anyway, that they had articles in the magazines that Holden Village was here and it was something new and exciting and people should stop by. And so that summer of the World's Fair, there were 1,600 people that came to Holden Village. And the year before, I think there had been 500. And so those 1,600 people basically allowed Holden to make inroads into some word-of-mouth publicity. And, you know, people that came, they usually only came for a couple days, but they loved it, and it was very primitive, but I suppose it reminded them of Bible camp and had pleasant memories of Bible camps, and so that this was, in their mind, sort of an adult Bible camp. And so fortunately, those 1,600 people then really created, you know, we had those names in, not in a computer, there were no computers at that time, but in our database as far as the, you know, mailings and so forth, and that's really what allowed Holden to start in those days, is both from a financial standpoint as well as from a publicity standpoint. So it was mailings, you know, to these people and their word of mouth telling other Lutherans in the Midwest, so it was a very important part of the whole history of Holden, the World's Fair in Seattle. Without that, you know, Holden may have started, but it would have been a lot harder to get going. After 61, when I was up here, I was also excited about it, and I was working with Boeing at the time, and then volunteered. I wrote to Gil Berg and asked him about volunteer opportunities up here, and so in 1963, I was accepted as a volunteer here, and I took a leave of absence from Boeing, and just planning on coming up here for the summer, and then would go back in the fall in September to continue my work in engineering. And so I was assigned, I was the kitchen coordinator, I think was the official title I had. Of course, I wasn't a cook or chef, but I guess I was in charge of ordering and also in charge of staffing of the kitchen, you know, and making sure that it was covered. So that's what I did for basically 3 months from Memorial Day to Labor Day. And it also had the extra advantage that I was living in up above the kitchen in the hotel. And so that there was heat coming up from the, there was hot water there. So, I mean, I was living in luxury compared with some of the other volunteers that were in the area. But those are the things that, how things got started, and that was during the time that I got acquainted with Carol Hinderly. He came in June of that year. The program got started. Carol had a very minimal program opportunity at that time, but some great people, and we'll talk a little bit more about the program another day. But those were what really got started, and it allowed Holden in a very real way to take hold, and just gradually word of mouth, you know, we got enough people to support it. The churches were doing minimal, basically. I think the ALC or AELC, they gave, I think it was $7,500 a year, and the LCA gave $5,000 a year, and the Missouri Synod gave $2,500 a year. But we were trying to involve the youth departments of these organizations, because initially they didn't really have a program plan for Holden, but somehow they thought that, you know, either youth or young adults, and the church had never been successful at putting together any kind of a young adult program. In fact, you came up with the Young Adults Tehachapi, you mentioned, and that was the first sort of program that the youth departments tried to put together. And I think there were three different sessions of the Young Adults Tehachapi, and Tehachapi, you know, is the city at the end of the lake, or the community, and that means a way through. It was a Native American word, I guess. Anyway, and that introduced a lot of young adults, you know, to Holden, which then, you know, helped to get volunteer staff. But it also proved that the youth departments probably could not program Holden. Either they didn't have the innovative spirit of doing it, or they were still thinking in terms of Bible camp. And I think the one thing that the board had decided is that Holden shouldn't be just an adult Bible camp. It had to be more than that. And so the young adults to Hikendo did bring some people. And I don't know if you remember Karen Strum. Was she here at that time? That
I don't think she was here yet.
Yeah. And Karen was one of the great employees of volunteers as well as employees. And Karen had been to the University of Minnesota, had gotten an advanced degree in computer work, which didn't help up here, but she was an exceptionally brilliant young lady that was looking for something to do. And she really grew up in the diplomatic corps. Her father was in the diplomatic corps, and I think she was born in Vancouver, BC, but grew up in Mexico City and various places around the world. So she had a marvelous sort of world view of the whole situation, and very brilliant. I just visited her for a short time in Leavenworth, and it was great to see her and just visit a little bit with her. But she came up at that time, and then she came back as a volunteer, and then later as our registrar. And she really was the one who set up the registration, in a more professional way. But it again the sort of the quirks of how things happen, how, you know, people would come here and get acquainted with it and then, you know, contribute in a very special way. Holden started out without any kind of a bank account. It was zero. I mean, we had nothing. And again, that first summer where there were 1,600 people came up here, that helped a little bit, plus gifts. When I started, I was working with Boeing as an engineer, and I definitely took a pay cut to come up here, but I was single at the time and didn't really care because I was excited about Holden and I had no debt, so coming up here was a great opportunity to live in the mountains and actually get some pay. So it was a marvelous experience. But Holden had no bank account, and when Gil Berg, he owned a oil distributing plant or an oil distributing system in Seattle, and very successful, and was relatively wealthy and was very generous with. He was the chairman of the board of LBI at that time. Very generous with gifts to LBI and gifts to the church and so forth. And then he got involved with Holden as sort of the volunteer manager and director those first couple of years. And so it was partly his money that he was willing to share just to get things going. And I think the truck is still here, the original flatbed truck. I know a couple of years ago, or for the 50th anniversary, they had it parked down here. And that was the first truck that a motorized vehicle really that Holden had, and he loaned Holden $1,200 to purchase it. This was 62. I don't know that he ever got paid back for that. I don't remember. He may have, but I would rather think that he probably then listed as a gift eventually. But initially it was a loan. And to my knowledge, that's at least in the first 20 years, and I'm not familiar with the finances now, but Holden never did borrow money. I mean, we had, in those first 20 years, there was, maybe some individuals associated with Holden were very generous, but it really wasn't a loan, it was a gift. But we had no basis to go to a bank and get a loan for anything, because they wouldn't have given it to us. And we knew it, and they knew it, so we didn't go. But in those years, again, it was, it was almost day to day. But we always somehow came up with just enough money to go to the next month, And I remember in 63 and 64, 65, those few years that I went down to Wenatchee, and we bought all of our food from an outfit called Pacific Fruit and Produce. I don't think they exist anymore, but I know they don't exist in Wenatchee, and that's where we got all of our food, basically, our vegetables and canned things and so forth. And I went down there in June, and I said, I don't think we can pay pay you anything, but would you be willing to give us, you know, credit ahead? Because we have some big groups coming in, or in August of this year, and I know that we can pay you when those groups, you know, come here and pay their bill and so forth. And they had done business with Holden, or with Holden the mine. And so that was one advantage we had, that Holden had a wonderful reputation in Chelan and Wenatchee with businesses, because the mine, you know, was very lucrative to some of the businesses. And Pacific Fruit and Produce was one of those. And they said, sure, yeah, we'll be glad to carry you for, you know, a few months, and hopefully you can pay it in August when those groups are here. And I had Clyde Green, who had the fuel distributorship in Chelan, where we got our diesel fuel and our gas. He was a member of the Lutheran Church down there, so at least we had some contact with him. And he said the same thing. He said, yeah, he said, I mean, this was when, in the days when diesel fuel was 17 cents a gallon. And, I mean, that was really high. In fact, you probably heard the stories where the diesel electric plant, you know, that supplied our electricity, we couldn't afford to keep it going 24 hours a day. So at 10:30 every night, we shut off the diesel plant. It was totally dark. There was no electricity in the village. And everybody was asked to bring a flashlight, and people loved it. I mean, it became sort of a magical time for people. Probably more conversation started after 10:30 than before. They would gather together in, you know, various places and have conversations and, you know, talk about, now there's an official organization called the Dark Sky Initiative. In fact, it was started in Tucson because of all the observatories around Tucson. And it's trying to promote dark skies for observatories and just for the enjoyment of watching the sky. And in fact, I think the national parks now have a designation, a dark sky designation for some of the national parks if they are able to comply. Anyway, at 10:30, the electricity was going off because diesel costing 17 cents a gallon was just too expensive for us to do for the whole time. When the hydro plant actually came online in, I think, August of 1964, that we had electricity, you know, around all 24 hours. And the guests who had been here before actually sent a petition to the board requesting that the lights go off at 10:30, even though we had electricity from the hydro plant. And you know, and we even considered the possibility of having an extra power line run into the village from the hydro plant so we could keep refrigeration going, but turn off the lights. Fortunately or unfortunately, you know, at that time we were starting to get into the insurance issue. And we had a wonderful insurance agent from Seattle that was also a member of one of the Lutheran churches. And I think we probably couldn't have gotten insurance without him, because, you know, who's going to insure people riding up the back of a truck up the mountain roads and being here without any, I mean, we had fire hoses, but we didn't have much of a ability to fight fires up here. And anyway, he said, you know, I'll do everything I can for you, and I'll get you insurance, but you've got to keep your lights on just for safety's sake. And so that, I think after a couple of years, people that had been up here finally accepted the fact that, you know, the lights weren't going to go off at 10:30 night. But it was, I mean, a lot of these quirky little things that have happened over the years, you know, I think are important just to remember how, you know, unique and unusual the things were. I mentioned that the Holden board selected Carol to be the director, and that summer, it was the summer of 1963, that I was a volunteer up here, and so I got well acquainted with Carol, and I guess Carol, you know, felt that I was compatible working with him, because Carol was a unique person, and if some of you remember Carol, and not everybody could work with him. And in fact, that 14 years after I had worked with Carol up here, that His assistant in the old, at the youth departments of the ELC came up, he was visiting up here, and he came up to me and he said, okay, now you have the record of working with Carol the longest of anybody in the history. And I took that as a compliment. I thought that was good, because Carol and I always, I got along well. I mean, he knew, I mean, he didn't care at all for the facilities. I think the facilities scared him. And of course, I'm not a program person, so I had no interest in interfering with the program. So, I mean, we had a great division, and there were just the two of us. I mean, thinking now of how many management people there are in the village, and I'm not criticizing, it's just things change. But at that time, it was Carol Hinderly and myself, and then everybody else basically were volunteers. In fact, I visited with John and Mary Schramm a few days ago, and John was saying, well, how many people did we have on stipends up there? And I said, well, there weren't very many. I think we came up with, besides Carol and myself, who were basically paid, then we had maybe six people that were receiving some kind of salary or stipend, like the head of the kitchen. The kitchen was really the main thing that we paid some people to do. The mechanic was, at that time, was all volunteer. The carpenter was all volunteer. Plumbers were all volunteer. I mean, we didn't really have any paid people except for the kitchen staff. And I think we had initially just one person, and then two, and I think third one was added. It was a very unusual thing. And another thing that I think was indicative of those early years is Carol and I had offices where now the registration office is. Mine, Carol's was on the inside, I think, where the actual office is, and I can't remember the other offices, what it is right now, but that was my office. And for all the time that we were there, there was still a sign on the outside door going into those offices that it was the food service manager, and that was from the mine days. I mean, we didn't even change the sign indicating that this is where the management crew was for Holden Village. Those type of things just weren't important. And I think that people at the time, in fact, another little story, that when I retired from here, I came back, I think a year later, just to visit, and I was just out of courtesy was going to say hello to the new director that was here. At that time, the office had already moved up here. And I went up there, and I went into the office, and there was a secretary there. And I said, I'd like to say hello to so-and-so. And she said, well, you'll need an appointment. And at that point, I knew that things were changing. And I'm not criticizing. It's just that things do change. But in those first years, that, you know, even if the door wasn't open, anybody was welcome to come in. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was sort of a walk through my office to the outside, and Carol used it going outside. In fact, we often joked that, I mean, one of the reasons that we got along very well is that neither of us were really interested in staff meetings. And so that I think the 13, 14 years I worked with Carol, we never had a staff meeting or a management meeting. I think that I mentioned the book. By the way, I wrote a book, in case you're interested, that has a lot of this history in it. I mentioned in there that if we ever had a staff meeting, it was the five steps that Carol did from the outer office through my office until he got outside. And he would often say, you know, we need to do this. You know, and by that time he was outside already. You know, it was the uniqueness of how Holden got started, and I think why in some of those early years the community started building up in a very realistic way. I mean, community is a big part of Holden back then and it is today, and that community is, you know, being lost in this nation with the return to more tribal existence of everything. That's another story. I don't have permission to do a session on tribes, so I can't do that. But anyway, when you have a community, then you don't have a division of some of these things in the community. And there really wasn't much of a division between, Carol and I were really embarrassed that we were being paid. because we had the advantage of being paid and staying up here where everybody else was a volunteer or a guest. So, you know, we considered ourselves to be, you know, just a part of the community, and we were involved in everything. And I think, again, at those early days, it set the ability for a community to be established here that has allowed Holden to continue on. And, you know, we had people come back year after year after year that really looked upon Holden as their sort of lifeline. And again, to get a little bit more into another session, we deal with programs. But right at that time, you know, a lot of lay people in the church weren't much involved in theology. And some of you who are more mature can remember that it was the pastor who did the theology, and you listened, and you gave the offering, and went to potlucks and had Jell-O, and that was it. Holden, and this was one of the beauties of Carroll, and he really, if there was ever a program theme, it was making humans whole again within the church, because the church had done a good job of dividing humans into the youth department, or into youth groups, the men's group, the women's group, and I can't remember, some other groups. But Carroll was bound and determined to try to have Holden bring humanity back together. So it was, you know, so that we as humans would have our intellectual curiosity fed, our spiritual curiosity fed, and our physical being improved. So that, you know, with the hiking, with the work, and so forth, that in a sense was the program of Holden, and it's why I think a lot of people, love to come up here. What time is it? Oh, love to come up here is because they were at that point living in sort of divided church, and up here it was all one. The worship was sort of continuous. You know, we did have vespers and matins, but you know, sort of all day long. In a sense, you were involved in appreciation and worship and joy of life and conversation. If there was ever a place where you could easily converse with people, it was the Holden Village, because you'd come up lake, and then you'd come up on the bus, and you'd get here, and you know, there was, you know, no television, no phones, no communication of any kind. I mean, now Holden really has the luxury of some pretty good communications. I'm bound and determined that I'm not going to get on the internet, because I don't want to break my experience of never having been on the internet at Holden Village. So even though I can, I'm not going to do it. And because in those early days, there was no communications. And it was a totally different, mail was our only opportunity from a business standpoint or from a social standpoint. If we needed to buy something, we ordered it by mail. And it was, you know, took a day down or two. And then, so we sometimes didn't get things we ordered for, you know, a week or longer. And it was a different existence, and we got by, and that's again where the mine, was so important to us. The junkyard at the mine became our source of steel and various, even some plumbing parts. I mean, we would go up there, we would have a plumbing problem, and, you know, we knew we couldn't get a new valve for X number of days, and so we would go up there and oftentimes find something that would still work. And so the old mill and the mine was sort of a sacred part of the early Holden. That's why I said initially that I'm sort of sad to see that it's gone. But those were again the early days when things were just a little bit different. So the other thing, going back to sort of the finances of it, those first couple years in 63, 64, 65, we had two groups miraculously showed up. The first one was the CFO, and it was the Camp Farthest Out. When we first heard it, we thought it was Camp for the Stout. I think the CFO is still in existence today, and it's a non-denominational group of people that love to get together in camping. And I'm not sure, but I think it's still in existence today. But at that time, it was a very powerful group, and it wasn't associated with any church. It was really non-denominational. And it was in various parts of the country. And the Northwest found out about Holden and started coming up here, and they brought like 200 people, which was marvelous for Holden, because we didn't have that many people coming up here to pay at that time. And the volunteer staff at that time, we had to have meetings before they would arrive and say, now this group is going to be a little bit different. You know, don't stand around and gawk and don't laugh and don't say anything. Just be very nice. And, you know, there are guests, and also there are bread and butter. And, I mean, one thing they had was devotions in motion, which a lot of the staff thought was very interesting. And basically, it's probably what yoga is today, but in a more spiritual sense, they had devotions in motion where they had a leader go through various calisthenics. But I think with spiritual music and, I don't know, maybe readings, I can't remember. But they were a marvelous group. In fact, some of our future volunteers ended up coming back from the CFO and coming back and then being volunteers here because they loved Holden and, you know, they loved what Holden was doing. In fact, the first car I ever bought was a Volvo, a 1970 Volvo. And the person who owned Ravenna Motors in Seattle, if some of you are from Seattle, I think Ravenna Motors is still in business over there. And he owned Ravenna Motors. And when he was up here, he was one of the leaders of CFO. And I said, you know, I need to get another car. And he said, oh, come down and I'll fix you up. And he did. So I had that 1970 Volvo for, I don't know, 25 years or something. It was a marvelous car, but they were a marvelous group of people that, in a real sense, had a lot of the history of Holden. I mean, we could thank them for Holden getting started. The other was the Air Force Spiritual Life Conference. And I don't know if they do it anymore, but the chaplains of the Air Force would have a Spiritual Life Conference every year, and they again found out about Holden. And so that they contacted us, and we were delighted because, again, most of them came from McCord Air Force Base, I think. Maybe some from Spokane, but I think it was just the Northwest. And again, they bring the military people that I guess belong to the various churches on the bases and so forth, and came up here. But it only lasted for a couple of years because after the second year, I think somebody in Washington told them that they could no longer come here because it was too dangerous. I mean, this was the military. I'm not criticizing the military. My brother is a military, retired. Anyway, and the reason for that was that even the 2 years they were up here, they were required to keep a medic and an ambulance down a 25-mile creek. So that in case there was any person that got hurt or got sick or anything, that they could get them down a 25-mile creek and then taken by ambulance to the hospital. But that was required, so all of the week that they were up here, there was a medic sitting down there. I remember the guy who told us about it, he was really apologetic. He says, you know, it's not dangerous up here, but you know, you've got to understand that rules are rules, and so that they weren't able to come back. But again, they, for 2 years, they really sort of bankrolled Golden Village, and it was very important to have these groups here. So, you know, again, whether God encouraged these groups to come, I don't know, but it was fortunate that we had. Well, I guess we're getting close. I don't know if any of you have any questions or anything. That
I had a question about the Air Force. Weren't they here for just a week or two?
Yeah, they were just, yeah, the Air Force was here for a week and the CFO was just here for a week.
Yeah, just a week.
Yeah, it was a short time, but it was lucrative as far as Holden Village was concerned, so. Yes?
Just briefly, could you tell us how Mary and John Schramm are?
How they are?
Yeah.
Oh, they're doing very well. They just, they sold their little house on the Icicle Road where they were, and moved into town into a rental where they can walk to church and walk to the stores and so forth. But it was interesting that Mary asked me when we were sitting there talking, she said, well, how are you doing in retirement? And I said, well, I think it's boring, and I'm not needed anymore. And she said, well, John's the same way. And I said, well, I even still have dreams of Holden Village every once in a while that they're going to call me and ask me to come back to help with something. And Mary said, well, you know, that's interesting. John also has dreams about Holden. So they're doing very well, and they're, you know, as all of us, they're slowing down. And I think they wish they could be more useful in society, as you know. But I think other than that, they're doing very well. So, you know. And Karen Strum was glad that I was able to come up here, and I told her I would email her a full report when I got back there. I won't be able to see her, but I'll email her a report. And that again is the marvelous thing, is that actually as a result of writing this book that I've been able to get in contact with some of the early people that I had lost contact with. And Todd Corey, I don't know if any of you remember him, he was a volunteer, very young, you know, in his 19, maybe 20, and was very, very brilliant in electronics and so forth. And somehow I got back in contact with him. He's in Mount Shasta, California now, and a marvelous guy, and one that, you know, says over and over how Holden has changed his life over the years, and he, you know, he's still very appreciative of what he had. And Holden, in a very real sense, I mean, I always sort of described Holden as an arena for, you know, a lot of people to come that needed a place that was safe, you know, because in those early years, not only with the young adults, but also like with the clergy. You know, the clergy were going through a lot with the Missouri Synod and the Seminex and even the other Lutheran bodies that some of the pastors were, you know, getting to be a little liberal for the conservative church. And Holden Village supplied the arena for a lot of clergy as well as a lot of youth. And I really think it had a and really a tremendous impact on society and the church, the number of, you know, youth that came here. And I remember getting letters, in fact, one specific from a seminary professor in Minneapolis or St. Paul, and he wrote and begged me to accept their daughter on staff, because I wish I would have saved the letter, but, you know, it said that we're afraid we're losing her as a daughter, and we're afraid we're losing her as a Christian. Something's happening to her. We want her to come up to Holden. Please accept her, even if you don't need her. And I wrote back and said right away, of course we'll accept her. And she came up and was here for the summer. And I wrote back and said, well, I just from my limited experience, I'll guarantee you that she'll change, and probably for the better. But I can't guarantee you'll ever have a daughter, or she may never be a Christian, but I can guarantee you that you know, she'll change. And he was so appreciative. And, you know, this happened, we never turned down anybody in those years. I mean, I guess we were so grateful that Holden existed, and we saw how people were changed by this experience, that if somebody came up, needed us, we accepted them. I mean, another example was a young fellow from New York who, you know, they still have coffee breaks, I think, up here, but it was during the summer, and we were out having coffee break, and I remember I saw this guy walk in down the road here and sort of stand and look up, and he had a pack on, and he was barefoot. And, you know, and I went down and talked to him, asked him if we could be of any help or anything, and he said, What is this place?
Yeah.
What did I get into, you know? I've just been hiking out in the Cascades to try to find something in my life. And he had just gone through, he was a piano technician from New York that had studied with a famous technician, I guess. Anyway, he didn't think he wanted to go into piano technician work, tuning, basically. And so he decided to go out to the Cascade Mountains and hike and try to find his way. And so he came in here, and he, you know, I told him what it was, and he said, can I work here? I said, sure, yeah, just take all your pack and we'll assign you a room. And he stayed here for all summer. and then ended up marrying somebody from here. And they lived in Chelan for many years, and now I think they're over on the coast. I haven't had contact with them. But it was sort of typical of what would happen in those years with people that either from the outside or, you know, would come through and just say, you know, we need this place. I mean, they didn't say it like that, but, you know, can I stay here or can I work here for a little while, you know? And so it was a great experience, and many, many, many people that I think are, you know, their lives have been changed. Well, Alex, I think, is one of them. He was one of our great volunteers, and it was so great to see him now coming up here. Again, just sort of typical of people who got acquainted with the community, and the community is the big thing. I mean, we lack community in the world today, and Holden, you know, I think provides that in a unique way. And I remember, in fact, I can't remember now. Somebody talked to me this morning. Oh yeah, you, Catherine, yeah. And she went into the ministry, and when she was telling me that, I always sort of prided myself because, you know, a lot of people, I'm not a counselor, and I don't like to deal with people's problems. But a lot of people, you know, a lot of the staff would come up to me, or even sometimes guests, and would say, you know, we want to be more a part of the church. You know, I think I'll go to seminary. And I'd say, don't go to seminary. You know, that's the last thing we need is more preachers. You know, what we need, is successful attorneys and successful doctors and successful technicians, and, you know, because the church needs those people in order to stay alive. Don't become a pastor. So I sort of prided myself of talking more people out of the ministry. Carol was responsible for talking people going to the ministry. I talked them out of it. Anything else that, I guess that it's about 12 o'clock, so. So thank you for coming, and we'll have another session.